Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Good evening, everyone. Today we will start to study Sutta number 140 in the Majjhima Nikaya. This is called the Dhatu Vibhanga Sutta, the exposition of the elements, the analysis of the elements. This is on page 1087 in the middle-length discourses of the Buddha. And this is a very beautiful, poetic, and deep sutta. Okay, the sutta begins when the Buddha is wandering in the Magadhan country. Magadha is the central state of northeast India, the state that corresponds with present-day Bihar. And eventually he arrived at Rajagaha. Actually, he was probably in the suburbs of Rajagaha. And then he went to the shop or the shed of a potter who's called Bhagava. Bhagava. It seems Bhagava was a kind of clan name of potters. Plus, in the Buddhist texts, almost all potters have this last name, Bhagava. And says to him, he asks whether it would be permissible for him to spend a night in his workshop. This was a regular practice among the wandering ascetics, as they would be roaming over the roads, paths, highways of India. When night would come, they would need a place to take shelter, and so often they would look for a potter's shed. Out of politeness, they would ask the potter whether they can have permission to spend the night there. And in ancient India, and even up to quite recent times in India, every town, every village, well, every town would have many, many potter shops, potter sheds, and every village would necessarily have a potter shed. Because it was the potters who made all of the dishes that people use. They would make it out of the clay. Okay, and the Buddha is in for what might be a little surprise, because somebody seems to have beaten him to it, another wandering ascetic. Paragraph 3 tells us that there was a clansman, who's here referred to as Kulaputta, which it's literally translated here, clansman or son of family. It's a term used for a young man whose name is Pukusati. And this young man had gone forth from the home life into homelessness out of faith in the Buddha. And on that occasion, he was already staying in the potter's workshop. Now, he's not described as a bhikkhu, as one who is ordained as a monk, but he's one who has gone forth into the homeless life. We'll come to his story in a few moments. And now, the Buddha seemingly doesn't know that this young man has gone forth out of faith in himself. He just sees this young man wearing the robes of an ascetic. He would not have been wearing the formal robe made up in this distinctive style of a Buddhist monk, but he would have been wearing just the saffron robes that were very commonly worn by ascetics of any school in ancient India. Saffron, ochre, brownish, with shaved head, no beard, carrying an alms bowl, perhaps a walking staff, some other traveling bag, shoulder bag. And so the Buddha goes up to this young man who's described as Venerable Pukkusati, though he's not yet described as an ordained monk, and says to him, if it is not inconvenient for you, actually he does address him as bhikkhu, but when he calls him bhikkhu, it doesn't mean that he's formally ordained as a Buddhist monk, since bhikkhu was a common designation used in India in this period for those who lived by going on alms round. The word bhikkhu means one who lives by bhikkha. Bhikkha is alms food. So, one who collects alms food by going on alms round is a bhikkhu. So he says, if it is not inconvenient for you, bhikkhu, let me stay one night in the workshop. And this young man, this young ascetic, says, this workshop is quite large. I don't need the whole space for myself. You too, Venerable One. And he refers to the Buddha, calling him Venerable One. He calls him Ayasma. This is like a friendly greeting that one monk might use for another. It doesn't imply special respect and veneration, even though it's translated venerable. But it's not, an ordinary monk wouldn't call the Buddha Ayasma, not at all. But this is the address that monks would refer to each other as Ayasma. So he says, let the Venerable One, like brother, or it's almost like saying brother. Brother, you can stay here as long as you like. Okay, so the Buddha comes into the potter's workshop, spreads a mat of grass at one end, and sits down, folds his legs, and sits in meditation. And so then the Buddha sits most of the night in meditation, and this ascetic, Pukkusati, spends most of the night in meditation. And though the Buddha is sitting in meditation, but out of the corner of his eye, he's looking at this ascetic, and also with his super divine eye, he's examining the mental faculties of this ascetic. And then he sees that this young man is quite impressive in the way he conducts himself. Let me question him. And so at some point they both end their meditations. And so the Buddha begins a conversation with this young ascetic and asks him, under whom have you gone forth, bhikkhu? Who is your teacher? And whose Dhamma, whose doctrine do you profess, do you follow? These were the types of questions when wandering ascetics met each other and they wanted to begin a conversation. These were the questions that they would use to open a conversation. And so now, Pukkusati is going to reveal his own allegiance. And so he tells this older ascetic who's come into the workshop, he says, friend, he calls him Avuso, which is again a very informal way of addressing him. Friend, there is an ascetic named Gotama, the son of the Sakyans, who went forth from the Sakyan clan and had a good report about that blessed one. The Gotama has been spread to this effect. And then, yeah, this is obviously probably the work of the compilers of the text, using the standard words of homage to the Buddha, that this blessed one is an arahant, fully enlightened, perfect in true knowledge and conduct, sublime, sukhata, knower of the worlds, incomparable leader of persons to be tamed, teacher of gods and humans, the enlightened one, the blessed one. I have gone forth under that blessed one. That blessed one is my teacher, and it is his Dhamma, his doctrine, that I profess. And now the Buddha asks him, he wants to find out a little more about what this young ascetic knows. So he says, where is that blessed one accomplished and fully enlightened? Where is he now living? They're now in Rajagaha. If you want to see where they are, there's a map on page, would be on page 76, which is unnumbered, but if you go to page 75 and look on the reverse side, see the state of Magadha. Quite far in the east. And the young man says that the Buddha is now living in Savati. Savati is in the state of Kosala. That's to the left. If you can locate Kosala on the map, and it's going up close to the Himalayas. See the Himavanta? So it's quite far away from Rajagaha, perhaps 200 miles or so. 300, I think it's 300, about 300 miles. Okay, and now the Buddha asks a rather telling question. He says, Bhikkhu, have you ever seen the Blessed One before? And would you recognize him if you saw him? Of course we know the answer to that question. But the young man confesses that he's never seen the Blessed One before. And obviously, he wouldn't recognize him if he saw him. Okay, now we see here what seems to be a very matter-of-fact, very plain conversation between what could be an ordinary, young, wandering ascetic who's gone forth out of faith in the Buddha, and the Buddha who is appearing just like any wandering ascetic meeting this young man in a potter's shop. The commentary gives a story, a background story, to explain what lies behind this meeting. Sometimes one doesn't know whether or not to trust commentary or background stories, but I feel I should relate the background story. And at least part of this background story is actually included in one version of this sutta, which was transmitted to China and translated into Chinese. It's a version which was not included in any of the Agama collections, but was preserved in the Chinese Tripitaka as an independent translation, quite an early translation. I picked up this information from the studies by my friend Venerable Analayo. Jian, is he one of the very early Chinese translators? Do you know the name Jian? Yeah, he was the translator of this version of the sutta. And part of that, the background information that comes in the commentary, is also included in that version of the sutta that was translated into Chinese. In this background story, Pukusati was originally a king. The king of the state of Gandhara, the capital of which was the city of Takshila, also known as Takshila. Gandhara now corresponds to part of Pakistan, maybe overlapping with the eastern part of Afghanistan. Takshila or Takshila is in Pakistan, or at least the remains of it are. He must have become a king at a very young age, because the text refers to him as Kulaputta, which means son of family or young man. So how did this king wind up as a Buddhist ascetic? Now, there were trade routes between the powerful state of Magadha and the state of Gandhara, especially the city of Takshila, which was a very prosperous city, a very powerful city. And merchants would travel between the city of Rajagaha and the city of Takshila. And in the course of the travel, when merchants from Magadha traveled to Takshila, they would bring information to Takshila about the state of Magadha. And King Pukusati heard reports from these merchants about King Bimbisara, who was the very righteous, very virtuous king of Magadha. Bimbisara, from an early period, became a disciple of the Buddha. He had attained Sotapatti, stream entry, and he was a very devout supporter of the Buddha and the Sangha. In fact, it was Bimbisara who donated to the Buddha Sangha the bamboo grove. Pukusati was very impressed by these reports that he heard about Bimbisara, and so he established a kind of long-distance friendship with Bimbisara. they had never met, but through the merchants, they would send greetings to one another. Then, as a token of friendship, Pukusati decided to send to Bimbisara some precious carpets or blankets. They were blankets. It seems that this area of Gandhara must have been famous for the quality of its wool. And so he took 8 very precious blankets, rolled them up, wrapped them in these cylinders adorned with precious gems, and then sent them to Bimbisara. And when Bimbisara opened them, he was awed by this act of generosity on the part of his unseen friend. And so he thought to himself, what can I do to reciprocate the generosity of this royal friend of mine? And he thought, any kind of material gifts that I might give him would be of limited value. But here I am, the king of a kingdom in which there flourishes gems that are much more precious than any kind of material gems. These are the gems of the 3 jewels. So let me send my unseen friend information about the 3 jewels. And so he had sheets of gold prepared, fine beaten gold, had them adorned maybe with actual gems, and then on these sheets of gold he had written verses informing him about the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha, inscribed with passages from the texts. Of course, the texts were not written down, but passages extolling the virtues of the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha. And on one of these sheets, he had the instructions written on the practice of mindfulness of breathing, anapanasati. Okay, and so he had these sheets of golden sheets rolled up, put into a cylinder, and then sent by messenger to the city of Takshila to be personally delivered to this young king Pukusati. Now when King Pukusati received this gift from his friend, unseen friend Bimbisara, he went into his palace, went into his inner chamber to open the cylinder. He opened the cylinder and read these verses praising the Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha. And as he read each of these verses, because of his prior merits and paramis from previous lives, as he read the verse extolling the virtues of the Buddha, immediately he was flooded with piti, with great joy and sukha, happiness. Then he read the virtues, about the virtues of the Dhamma. Again he was flooded with joy and happiness. He read about the virtues of the Aryan Sangha, and he was flooded with joy and happiness. Then he read some verses that Bimbisara had inscribed, describing the life of a monk the going forth into homeless life, the ascetic way of life of the monk, that filled him with joy and happiness. Then he came to the verses describing the practice of mindfulness of breathing. And he thought, why don't I try this myself? He crossed his legs. He sat there. He didn't have to struggle with wandering thoughts, angry thoughts, lustful thoughts. But very quickly, again, this is his previous practices, all coming together through sort of the previous cultivation, all breaking through the surface of the mind now. As he sat there, just starting to attend to the in-breath and out-breath, the five hindrances fell away, and very quickly he goes into first jhana, second jhana, third jhana, fourth jhana. And so he sits there absorbed in the deep equanimity of the fourth jhana for some time, comes out, and spends the next 2 weeks. There's just one faithful attendant, brings him his food and water. He spends the next 2 weeks sitting, enjoying the bliss of the jhanas, the equanimity of the fourth jhana. Then after 2 weeks, he starts to reflect, what am I going to do now? And meanwhile, the people are gathering out in the court. What's happened to our king? He gets a present from the state of Magadha, and we haven't seen him for 2 weeks. There are cases to be decided. There's foreign policy to be determined. There are this matter to be taken care of, that matter to be taken care of. Diplomats are coming from this state, that state. We need him to attend to the business of the kingship. He's thinking, do I really want to go on doing this? Then he starts looking at these passages that his friend Bimbisara had sent him, describing here a householder or a householder's son, how does it go again, having gained faith in the Tathagata, he abandons a lot, either a large circle of relatives or a small circle of relatives, either a huge sum of wealth or a small sum of wealth. He cuts off his hair and beard, puts on the ochre robes, and goes forth from the household life into homelessness. So he calls his faithful attendant and says, my friend, go to the cloth shop and get a few measures of ochre-colored cloth. What color cloth? Ochre-colored cloth. But kings don't wear ochre-colored cloth. No, I want ochre-colored cloth. Whatever you say, Your Majesty. And then, on the second floor, you'll find a razor. Bring that up at once. Okay, so the attendant brings up the razor and meanwhile goes down to the shop to buy some rolls of ochre-colored cloth. So while the attendant is down by the shop, the king takes his razor, shaves off the beard, cuts off the hair, just till it's down to just about inch or so. Meanwhile, after 15 minutes or so, the attendant comes back with the ochre-colored cloth. The king has it cut up, made up into pieces that fit over him, undergarment, overgarment. And then he starts descending from the palace, the upper story of the palace. The people in the lower stories of the palace see him coming down and think, oh, some ascetic must have been up there talking to our king. And he's coming down, down, down. Starts leaving the palace. And then the people, when they see the ascetic leave, they come rushing up and start looking in the upper stories, up rooms in the upper story. Our king isn't here. And somebody looks closely at that ascetic who's leaving and they say, that's our king. What's he doing? He's becoming an ascetic. He's trying to escape. And then they all flock to him and start begging him and pleading with him. What are you doing? Why are you doing this? And then he explains to them that my friend Bimbisara in Magadha has told me that a Buddha has arisen in the world, an enlightened one. He's told me about the wonderful teaching of the Dhamma, and I've decided that I'm going to enter the monastic order of a fully enlightened one and practice the holy life under the Buddha to gain liberation. And they tell him, his counselors tell him, you know how tricky other kings are. You can't trust the king of Magadha. This is really a plot to capture our kingdom. His intention is to try to get you to become an ascetic and to abandon your kingdom so that he'll send his armies here to capture our kingdom. You go back and sit on your throne and we'll go to Magadha and investigate to find out whether there's really such a thing as a Buddha and a Dhamma. But Pukkusati has complete confidence in his friend Bimbisara and says, I have no doubt at all in my friend Bimbisara. You choose a worthy person among you to rule the state. I have my mission, my destiny to follow. I will continue on my journey. Then without taking even an attendant, not even a servant, not even wearing a pair of sandals, going barefoot, he walks, not even going with a carriage, but following a caravan so that he'll have somebody to show him the road. He travels this whole distance, all the ways from Takshila. He thinks the Buddha is living in Rajagaha when the Buddha is actually staying in Savatthi. And as they are traveling along this journey, they pass through the city of Savatthi and the Buddha is in Savatthi. And so they pass the Buddha. But he never knows that the Buddha's main monastery is actually Jeta's Grove, Anathapindika's monastery in Savatthi. And so he travels, I think it's another 250, 300 miles, going on to Rajagaha, thinking the Buddha is there, seeking the Buddha, till he comes to Rajagaha and asks, where is the enlightened one? And then they tell him, the Buddha's not here now. The Buddha's in Savatthi. But the Buddha has used his divine eye or his special faculty of super knowledge to investigate what has been taking place. He does this every day. He enters into what's called the Mahakaruna Samapatti, the meditative attainment of great compassion. And then when he comes out of that, he surveys the world to see who is ripe for special attainments, who there is that he can benefit that day. And when he investigated that day, he saw Fukusati come into his field of vision, and he knew that this was the person that he had to help that day. And so usually when the Buddha travels, he travels in company with a great company of monks, or usually with a few selected disciples. But this day, quietly, without telling anyone, not even telling Ananda, his personal attendant, he just put all of his things away, took his bowl, and slipped out of Jeta's Grove in Savatthi, and then walked the whole distance from Savatthi to Rajagaha just for the express purpose of meeting Pukusati. And now the Buddha can vary his appearance to fit the situation. If the Buddha wants to impress a Brahmin who judges based on the 32 marks of a great man, the 32 Mahapurisa Lakana, then the Buddha will allow those 32 characteristics to shine forth so that that Brahmin will place trust in him based on those special characteristics. But in this case, the Buddha probably saw that the best strategy for gaining access to Pukusati, for being able to ripen and mature his spiritual faculties, was not to come in and announce, "Good evening, Pukusati, I am the Buddha." Probably at that point, Pukusati would have been too overwhelmed, and then he wouldn't have been able to develop that calm concentration that would have been necessary for his wisdom to ripen. And so, for that reason, the Buddha sort of suppressed, or it's not that he uses some mystical way to change his appearance, to disguise his appearance, but it's a kind of subtle suppression so that those distinctive marks of the Buddha don't stand out conspicuously. So he appears almost like an ordinary monk, just an ordinary wandering ascetic, maybe slightly more impressive than an ordinary monk, but otherwise not overwhelming, overpowering in his appearance. So it is at this point that they meet in the potter's shed. And when the Buddha asks these questions, again, this is the commentarial explanation, as though he doesn't know the purpose of Pukusati is being there, and who Pukusati has gone forth under. This is just the way to open the conversation. And it's a way of sort of playing naive, you might say, playing naive in order to put himself on the same level of Pukusati as though he's just an ordinary ascetic, opening a conversation the way any other ascetic might do so. Though the thought occurred to me as I was reading the text this afternoon again, in paragraph 6, the first sentence there, then the Blessed One thought, this clansman has gone forth from the home life into homelessness under me. Here it seems as if this is new information to the Buddha, not something that the Buddha had known in advance. But putting this thought into the Buddha's mind seems to be the work of the compilers of the canon, so we don't know for sure. So maybe we can see the sutta from both angles. On one angle as a mundane angle, as an ordinary meeting, well, no meeting with the Buddha is ordinary, but at one level as a meeting between this clansman and the Buddha, who doesn't know in advance who Pukkusati is and what he is doing in that potter's shop. And also have it the other way, as the commentary puts it, that the Buddha does know in advance that Pukkusati is a king who has renounced, a young king who has renounced his kingdom and gone forth under him, and is there on his way to meet him. In any case, now the Buddha thinks, let me teach him the Dhamma. Okay, so now the Buddha addresses Pukkusati and says, I will teach you the Dhamma. Listen and attend closely to what I shall say. Okay, and Pukkusati says, yes, friend. And he's, this ascetic, the Buddha says, I will teach you the Dhamma. Pukkusati still doesn't think that this is the Buddha. He just thinks that this ascetic is teaching his own Dhamma. Because Pukkusati says, yes, friend. He's still using the word aguso, like brother. So he's still addressing this, the Buddha, as an equal. And by the way, if you remember the first discourse of the Buddha, when the Buddha meets the five ascetics, and then the five ascetics see him coming, and then the five ascetics address the Buddha, and they say, Abhuso Gautama. Then the Buddha refuses to teach them as long as they are addressing him as Abhuso Gautama. That Abhuso Gautama is that word that's translated here as friend. In that case, the Buddha won't teach them while they are addressing him as friend, because those five ascetics are not recognizing him as the Buddha. And so they're not yet opening to him to receive his supreme message. Under those conditions, the Buddha will only teach them when they address him as Bhante. In that case, Bhante is that they are addressing him as the Bhagava, as the Tathagata, recognizing him as the one who's awakened. It doesn't mean when you address me as Bhante that you think I'm the Tathagata. But when it was first used, the word Bhante was used only in relation to the Buddha. Okay, so in that case, when they switch from the address Abhuso to Bhante, that means that they are now recognizing the Buddha as their teacher. And so then the Buddha will teach the five ascetics the Dhamma, which means that they're opening to him as their teacher. But in this case, the Pukkusati calls the Buddha Avuso. The Buddha still teaches him because the conditions are somewhat different. This is a different situation, so a different upaya, a different means is appropriate. Here the Buddha is taking advantage of a situation where Pukkusati, thinking of the Buddha just as another ascetic who happens to know a little bit more about the Dhamma, is the more appropriate way to get the message across. Okay, so now the Buddha begins the teaching with, this is what we call the Udesa, the summary or condensed teaching. So the Buddha says, Bhikkhu, this person consists of six elements, six bases of contact, and 18 kinds of mental exploration. And he has four foundations. I'm going to come to these terms in a moment. The tides of conceiving do not sweep over one who stands there. And the there means upon these foundations. And when the tides of conceiving, it's very beautiful in the Pali, manusava, the tides of conceiving no longer sweep over him, then he is called Muni Santo, a sage at peace. One should not neglect wisdom, wisdom. One should preserve truth. One should cultivate relinquishment. And one should train for peace. This is the summary, the Udesa, the outline, the condensed teaching of the exposition of the six elements. This is the sort of, it's called the Matika, the condensed teaching out of which the sutta or discourse will be unfolded or unpacked. And now the commentary makes a very interesting observation here. It's commenting on the first sentence of the summary where the Buddha says, starts with this person consists of six elements, six bases, and so on. He says that when the Buddha is teaching this Pukkusati, he doesn't begin the way he so often begins with the ordinary preliminary practice or the preparatory practice. But it says from the very beginning he teaches him the training in insight, the training in vipassana, the way to penetrate achanta sunyata, the ultimate or final emptiness, which is the foundation, the fundamental condition for the attainment of arahantship. The preliminary practices or the preparatory practices These would be the teachings on the purification of moral virtue, guarding the sense faculties, being moderate in eating, practicing mindfulness and clear comprehension, being diligent and vigorous in one's arousing energy, developing the four jhanas. But the Buddha knows the faculties of Pukkhasati, and this supports the commentary. So why should the Buddha knows the faculties of Pukkhasati. He knows, he's seen Pukkhasati sitting there like a statue throughout the night. He knows that Pukkhasati is able to go and sit for hours in the fourth jhana. So if a physics professor is teaching a class, a graduate seminar in quantum theory, he doesn't start teaching the basics of Newtonian physics to the class, but he starts right in on quantum theory. So in this case, the Buddha can start right in giving the instructions on developing panya, the wisdom that's necessary to reach the ultimate goal. Maybe I'll ask if there are any questions. Yeah.
If there was writing then, why did they wait so long to write the Buddha's?
Well, that's an interesting question. What I would have to say is I actually doubt it's a good question, and it occurred to me when I was reading that portion of the commentary. I doubt that that part of the commentary is very reliable. It seems to be projecting from the age of the commentators back into an earlier period. Because in the Buddha's time, texts were not written down. But that does not... The fact that that part of the story might be pious elaboration by later commentators doesn't negate the possibility that Pukkhasati could have been a king who had heard about the Buddha's teaching through messengers that have been that could have been sent by King Bimbisara.
Yes, the term you used, Panna, is that a Pali translation of a particular Sanskrit word?
The word that I used?
I think you said Panna.
Did I say Anupanasati?
You were talking about the insight that he was teaching. The Buddha was teaching the teacher to have insight, and that I didn't quite hear the words you used.
Vipassana.
Panya.
Panya. The panya is wisdom.
Okay.
That was the word. I didn't use the English word.
I'm just curious if you gave me the spelling of it.
Oh, okay.
Since I don't have the.
What's the word that means wisdom?
Yeah.
Yes, Peter?
In paragraph 6, when the Buddha says, I will teach you the Dhamma, is the other monk under the impression that he's going to be taught the Buddha's teachings, and that this is maybe a monk another multiple studies under the Buddha? Or is he just being polite and saying, okay, you know, I'm going forth to see the Buddha, but whatever you have to say, I'll listen to.
Okay, just for the recording. The question is, when the Buddha says in paragraph 6, I will teach you the Dhamma, does Pukkhusati think that the Buddha here, who he doesn't recognize as the Buddha, is going to be teaching him the Buddha's Dhamma, or that this could be an ascetic who's going to be teaching him his own Dhamma? My answer is, I don't know. And the commentary itself doesn't deal with that point. So if you have some time, let me go on to cover what I had intended to get as far as I intended to get this evening. I wanted to get through paragraph 12. Because most of it is material we've already covered. Okay, so now we come to elaboration of the summary. Okay, so this person consists of six elements with reference to what was this said. Okay, what are the six elements? The earth element, water element, fire element, air element, space element, and consciousness element. So that is the meaning of the statement, this person consists of six elements. Now, the six elements themselves are going to be elaborated further down when the Buddha discusses the training in wisdom. So we're going to come to a further elaboration of the elements, which is why the sutta the sutta is called the exposition of the elements. Then the person consists of six bases of contact. This is the six asayatana. So what are the six bases of contact? That is the base of eye contact, base of ear contact, base of nose contact, base of tongue contact. Actually, I don't like this translation so much. Let us say the eye as a base for contact, the ear as a base for contact, the nose as a base for contact, the tongue as a base for contact, the body as a base for contact, and the mind faculty as a base for contact. Okay, so those are the six bases of contact that a person possesses. Okay, then a person possesses 18 kinds of mental exploration. I think this is something new that we haven't had before. Now, according to the commentary, what is meant by mental exploration is manopavichar. Pali, it's manopavichara. It's mano plus upavichara. But when mano and upa come together, the U drops out. It just becomes manopavichara, as though there was no U there, because the O is stronger than the you, so it absorbs it. According to the way the commentary explains this, this is basically, it's the mental factor of vichara, which is the factor of mind responsible for examination or mental exploration, which works together with vitakka. Vitakka is thinking. So this is examination and thinking, discursive thinking. Okay, and this particular mental process works in 18 ways. We get 18 ways because it functions in relation to the 6 sense spheres. That's forms seen through the eye, sounds heard with the ear, and so on. And any object perceived through any sense faculty is capable of generating any of 3 types of emotions or feelings, let's say, any of 3 types of feelings. Joy, this is somanasa, or grief is too strong. Domanasa, you could say, is displeasure, dejection, dissatisfaction. It doesn't have to be grief. Even if you go outside and there's a gray sky and it makes you feel a little somber, that's a mood of domanasa. If you taste some food, you eat some food and the taste is not so agreeable to you, you don't like it, again, that's domanasa. And then there's equanimity or indifference. Okay, so we get that through the 5 physical sense faculties, and then with the mind faculty, in relation to any kind of idea, mental image, concept. Fantasy, judgments, speculations, propositions, all of those can be related to by way of, as we examine them, we can relate to them either with joy, with joy means happiness, gladness, or with displeasure, dejection, or equanimity, which can be either a superior equanimity, which means we're detached from it, or a kind of dull apathy, thick-skinned dullness. And then the more interesting one is paragraph 11. This person has 4, here the key word is foundations. The key word is the word that is translated foundations. The Pali word is adhikana. Some problem in how to translate this, because the word comes to be used in later literature. I'm not sure if it's used this way in the suttas, but in somewhat later literature it's come to be used in the sense of resolution or determination. This is the way Koenka uses it in relation to meditation. You make the adhikana to sit for the full hour without moving. That's his famous or infamous adhikana sittings. And then Venerable Nyanamoli had originally translated as the four resolutions. Then he crossed that out and used some other rendering, which I thought was not so successful. I don't remember what it was. But then I removed his second rendering, and I based on the commentary which glossed adhikana with patita, which means basis or foundation. And the word comes from, in Sanskrit, you could see the connection with the English word sthana. Sthana is like the English word stand. The root is sta, like station, stand. And adi usually has the sense of over, above, or upon. So that which one stands upon, that which stands over. So we could call these four stations, but I think four foundations is the best rendering. And these are four, you'll see the way foundation becomes the most satisfactory rendering. These are four qualities that one cultivates in the beginning stages of the practice, and then these qualities mature till they reach culmination with the achievement of the ultimate goal. And then, with the fulfillment of the ultimate goal, they become possessions or expressions of one who has achieve the ultimate goal. And so what are these four foundations? The foundation of wisdom, the foundation of truth, the foundation of relinquishment, and the foundation of peace. And so it was with reference to this that it was said, this person has four foundations. Okay, now we'll definitely stop at this point and then ask if there's any questions. Okay.
Is that adhikana related to satipatthana?
No.
Which is the other place we see the word foundation?
It's not related to satipatthana, but in satipatthana, satipatthana is actually sati plus upatthana. The word upatthana, that part tana, comes also from the same root. It's the Sanskrit root sta, or Pali root ta. But ta there is joined with a different prefix, the prefix upa. says upaplastana, upatana. Here it's atiplastana. So that the root is the same and the stem noun is the same, tana, but the prefix is different. Any further questions? Okay, then we'll stop. Now, I've been advised that it's better not to resume on January 2nd. So, I'll resume again on January 9th.